With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with something, you know.
And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Hello, this is part two of my Ramble Meets interview with Danny Murphy. So if you haven't listened to part one yet, stop what you're doing immediately and go back and listen to that one first. It's obviously not imperative and it will still make sense, but you might not have the context in the background that will make it more enjoyable. So do go listen to part one first. Okay, for those of you who are up to date and ready to go, we pick up part two of the story with Danny about to join Spurs from Charlton. All right, here we go. And moving forward to Spurs, I mean, I might be wide of the mark here, but I don't have a huge amount of knowledge of the issue. I see that you spend a year and a half at Spurs and there's no headline injury that I can find to speak of, but you didn't play an awful lot of games, or certainly not as many games as you'd have liked. What was the reason for that, Dan? Because you've said that there was no problem with Martin Jol, the coach, and it wasn't anything to do with him. What was the...
Well, we had a few issues.
Right, okay, fair enough.
No, but not... So I'll give you the detail. Basically, I got there at the end of Jan, which wasn't ideal. And then, of course, you know, they had a good side, by the way, and were playing well. It was only near the end of the season they lost a bit of form and we missed out. So he brought me in then, really, to help the squad, because they had Edgar Davids, Michael Carrick, JJ. I mean, a lot of good players. And I think planning for the Champions League season, where you needed a better squad of players and more of us. So I didn't play that many games when I first got there from January to the end. And that was okay, because I was with a good squad again. We were moving forward. And I didn't, you know, playing my bit here and there, coming on, helping the team, doing my bit. I was fine for then. I was looking to the future. Come the summer, went back, was fit. They bought one or two left. One or two came in. I thought, you know, well, okay, I'm going to start playing more. And it didn't quite happen to start. But I was fit and I was, you know, I was thinking, oh, when I get my chance, I'll take it. And I I can't think the exact timing of it, but I did start more good. I had a decent run in the team and played really well centrally, and then he moved me left. And that's where we had a few issues, because I couldn't really play wide anymore. And I was, and he had the likes of Steve Mulbronk, Tiano, Tanio, whatever
Timu
his name
Tanio,
was.
Yeah, the Finnish
Timu player, Tanio, yeah, good player. So we fell out a few times about that, because he'd moved me from playing really well to accommodate a couple of others coming back in. I think it was JJ at the time, whatever. But then while this was going on, and I'd started playing a few good games and just started feeling like part of it. And my dad was ill and rushed to hospital, and we weren't sure why. And ultimately, he was terminally ill, and I didn't know for a few more weeks after that, a month or so after that. And then I spent the next probably 2 months with him.
Right.
So the second season became a write-off, really, because by the time... So my dad got ill. My dad died in the March, but he'd been ill since December time. So the season only started the end, you know, August, September. So I'd only had 4 months, really, four months of that. And when my dad got ill and then passed, I came back. And obviously I was not in a great place mentally or physically at that point. And Martin was great, to be fair to him. And the club were great. Daniel was great with me as well. Great having Keno around. Keno had lost his dad years before. It was a big help for me. But that summer, there was a case of... I did have time left on my contract, but I said to Martin, you know, a lot's gone on. Some of it my fault. Some of it maybe yours. You know, yeah, it doesn't really matter. I think I need to go and play. You've got a good squad. You know, you don't want to play me centrally. I need to play central now. And actually, I spoke to Daniel. Daniel let me go to Fulham without a fee, which was a big thing, really, because I'd still had time on my contract. And that was because because he knew I'd done my best. You know, I'd not done anything wrong to hamper my time there. And he felt some sympathy towards my position and my plight at the time. And I could have gone to Fulham or Birmingham on the last day, and I went to Fulham.
And that's for me, just as a football fan, that's where the sort of Indian summer, the sort of second part of your career really went right, because this was an amazing time for you, really, particularly when Roy came in. Was it halfway through your first season, and you guys kicked on from there? Is that right?
Yeah, the first season was difficult because Laurie was in charge, and although Laurie brought me in, he had a one-dimensional way of playing, and we had a lot of good footballers: Simon Davis, Stephen Davis, myself, David Ealy, people like that. We didn't want to whack it, but it didn't work, and Roy came in, and got us playing, organised, and you know we saved our season with a miraculous recovery, and from that moment on. Because I was out of contract, I signed at Fulham on a 1 year, and I said I'll prove myself. It helped scoring on the last day of the season to keep them up, of course. Yeah, but yeah, you know, so me and Roy sat down, and Roy was looking into bring players, and you know, but he was more than happy to keep me. And we started that season with me and Jimmy, and then we ended up Jimmy left and Dixon came in, but Roy and I became really close and realised we were on the same page about a lot of things. And he realised, I think, that I could be his voice on the pitch. And the way he played suited me hugely, because I was playing central now and dictating things in a deeper role. He put legs around me. And because he likes to play narrow and compact, I wasn't getting exposed for the lack of pace or the lack of legs that I was getting in that age. So he built a team that was very wise, very good at what we did, made some great signings, and we just kicked on and on. And of course, we kicked on so much, he got the job at Liverpool.
Yeah, and you followed on this next season. I think you finished seventh in the Premier League the following season.
Seventh.
What's the difference, Danny, between playing with Jimmy Bullard in the midfield and the following season playing with Dixon Atuhu? What was the difference in the balance between you guys?
Jimmy was... a free spirit, you know. Jimmy wanted to go and get the ball off the right back, dictate play, go and end up on the right wing, get a cross in and be on the edge of the box, getting the knockdown. Played unbelievable talent, super technique.
Good energy as well.
Should have played a big, super fit, yeah, super fit. Didn't like a tackle.
No.
Didn't want to get involved in that, really, which is fair enough because of his slight frame. And actually, we both had good. He was a good passer like me. We liked overplaying me and Jim. You know, we'd pass it to death. Yeah. Great on set plays. We used to fight about set plays. He was better than me on set plays, though. He was a brilliant character, but we were too similar, really, in the end.
Yeah,
and ultimately there was. He didn't go because of that. He left because of he fell out with Roy, and he wouldn't adhere to the more regimented role that you had to play as a central midfielder in Roy's team.
Hmm.
And to be fair to Roy, and I'd say this to Jimmy's face, Roy gave him every opportunity, but Jimmy just didn't believe in playing that way. You know, Jimmy would say to Roy, look, I get you want to play that way. I don't, so don't play me. Play someone else.
Yeah, that must happen, though. I mean, players and managers have different ideas. I mean, you and Roy were clearly on the same page, right? You had a great lasting relationship as player and manager. But it stands to reason, people are different. You're not always going to have that sort of connection, are you?
Yeah, but I think there's a balance. So you've got to be careful. You've got to remember your place in football. Yeah. You're a player. The manager's there for a reason. Now, don't get me wrong. Me trying to win knockdowns and play long ball under Laurie Sanchez is never going to work. But I tried for a month or two to do it because he was the manager and respected him. When it then became detrimental to the group, I spoke up. Yeah. It's not about being detrimental to me. That comes after your first season or two, you know. But when you're Jimmy, for example, who's got the wonderful attributes that he had, he could have still used those in Roy's system. Yeah. He was still wanting him to get on the ball, but he just didn't want him defending on his own, going to press when he wanted. You know, like you had to do it as a team, otherwise it was never going to work. And that's why Dixon came in. And what Dixon did actually was, Dixon's brilliant at the physical aspect and the defensive part of the game. But Dixon actually learned and got better at the positional and the passing part of it, being a bit more productive and knowing when to get on the ball and when not to. So both partnerships worked in different ways. And then Siddy came in under Mark Hughes, and Siddy was quite a tenacious, tough tackling midfielder, which was fine for me because, you know, he would do a lot of the stuff I didn't want to do. So my partners at Fulham weren't a big deal, really. The strength in the team at Fulham was the collective. It wasn't just a central midfielder. Yeah. We had Damien Duff, Clint Dempsey, Simon Davies flanking us the whole time. Workaholics with great knowledge and great wisdom.
Yeah, it's a great team.
You know, it was a very, very wise team.
Yeah.
A very, very intelligent team.
Quickly before I come on to this Europa League run, which of course is the crowning sort of part of your time at Fulham, I suppose, even though you guys didn't win the final. When you talked a second ago about stepping up and speaking up against Laurie Sanchez, as a player and as a person, you're clearly someone who likes to speak their mind and be honest. How does that manifest itself when you stand up and say, look, I don't agree with this? What's the best way of going about that to a manager, do you think?
It depends on the circumstance and what's happened. I mean, obviously some things happen off the cuff. And normally with emotion involved, it becomes problematic because you're talking about managers losing face. You're talking about a disrespect. The best, most productive conversations come one-on-one. They're the best. Now, there are times when if you are articulate enough and you're calm enough to construct an argument in a group setting, which managers are generally better at because they plan it, you can make a lot of headway. Well, there was a brilliant example of, I think a manager, the best managers are generally, comfortable with their philosophy and they don't deviate too much. Although they'll sometimes listen and let you think let you think that they've heard you. But I remember working under Mark Hughes, who's another manager I respect, and he was trying to introduce a bit more pressing to our game, and we didn't have the quickest centre-halves, and we were a counter-attack team. And we did it a couple of times and got pumped. Man City was one game in particular. I think Liverpool did us as well. I think Man City beat us 5-2 at home, and Liverpool 5-2 or 5-3, off the top of my head. And I said to Mark, and others backed me after I stood up, but I said, look, Gaffer, you know, in a meeting, we're not a pressing team. We haven't got the legs to press, really. Because as soon as we come high, we've got the ball in behind kills us. we haven't got the pace. The lads at the back know that. I'm not suggesting when we play Blackpool at home, because under Roy we always play the same way. I'm not suggesting when playing Blackpool at home we can't go out on the front foot and press them and have a go, because we're better than them, right? I understand the change now and again that's needed, but we are a senior bunch of lads. Actually, maybe let us work it out sometimes ourselves, type thing. You know, let us just fall back to type when we want. And Brett Angerland stood up and said, "Yeah, well, I agree, because I struggle with this and blah blah blah." And in the end, Mark said, "Look, fair enough. If you're feeling that way, do what you need to do. You're senior players, and you know, appreciate you speaking up." Now, the difference is that was done in a calm way, and there's a respect there. The problems lie when you question a manager about something in front of the group that's proven him wrong and making him look silly. I don't think it, in the moment it feels good and it feels like you've got one over, but it's never going to be that advantageous to you as a player under that manager. The most difficult things come when you get a phone call from the chief exec or the chairman. The difficulty then comes about self-preservation or honesty about the group, the greater good, the club, or how well do you get all these things come into your head when you get asked those questions. There's lots of, I believe in football as a player that you've got to stand your corner. You've just got to try your best to do it in the right way. And that's something you learn as you get older.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Are you struggling to find something to watch during lockdown? You've drained Netflix, rewatched all your old favourites, and now you need something new? Well, we're here to help. Join us for Clash of the Titles, the podcast where two movies with something in common go head to head in a fight to the death.
Release the Kraken.
Well, not death. We just decide which one is better.
When they do a long shot of the crowd in the ivory tower, it's different to the close-up. And if you look closely, you can see E.T., Mickey Mouse, Chewbacca, Ewoks, and C-3PO.
So when Wolfgang Peterson went to Spielberg, went, "Yeah, could you maybe re-edit my movie?" Steven Spielberg went, "Yeah, yeah. Do you know what I'm probably going to cut out? E-T, mate. I made that." Find your new favourite movie or revisit an old classic with me, Alex Zane, Vicky Crompton, and Chris Tilley. New episodes out every Monday and Thursday.
Clash of the Titles is a Stakhanov production.
2009-10, you end up in the Europa League final. But what are some of your memories of that run to the final? Because you started very early, obviously qualifying round. You played a lot of games that season. Did you? What point did you guys start to believe that you could go as far as you went?
Well, we had to go to Basel in the last group game. Hmm.
You scored in the home game against them, didn't you? Because I was at that game. Yeah. I remember, side foot into the corner.
Yeah. But I think it was just pullback. Yeah, Andy Johnson. I can't remember. Easy finish. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, a pretty simple finish that one for me. But the away game was very relevant because they hadn't been beaten there for a long, long time. We had to win to go through the group. It was snowing. And furthermore, I'd been out the longest I'd ever been out in my career that season. 7 weeks I was out. Okay. I hurt a tendon. I ripped a little bit of the hamstring off my tendon on the back of my leg and then back of my knee. And I was the surgeon said I should have surgery. Off-hired surgeon. And I said, because the doctor was with me, said, well, you can let them heal on their own. It could take 6-7 weeks. I said, I'm doing that. And my first game back was that one. Hmm. So we went there with Bobby was brilliant that night as well. Yeah. And I tell you who played probably the best game is Fulham shoot, John Honorisi's brother.
Oh yeah.
He played on the right hand side and he put in a couple of great crosses for the goals for Bobby. But we beat them and we went
through.
Throwing? A little bit, yeah. Because I was blowing a little bit. It was freezing cold. You couldn't get your hair, you know, because it was so cold. But I'd played there a couple of times before, actually, for Liverpool, and had some good games there. So I was quite enjoying it as well. But the feeling after was a bit like, hold on, we're through. Mm. We've got half a chance, you know. And then we drew Shakhtar.
Holders.
And everyone went, oh, no, we haven't.
Yeah, exactly. But you squeezed past them, 3-2, but you beat them on at home 2-1, didn't you? And got a draw away, which is an amazing result, by the way.
Played brilliantly against them. That was a class show of defending and discipline, especially at home. Away they come on late to try and put us under the cosh, but it was a brilliant result. And then I got sent off stupidly.
You
missed the Juve game. Yeah. But probably do you know what? For me, the biggest memory of that. And I've seen it a lot on social media the last few days, was the semi-final second leg against Hamburg. Because we went a goal down. We got a 0-0 out there, which is where the final was going to be, by the way.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
We'd beaten the German champions, Wolfsburg, and which was a hell of an achievement because they were a good side, by the way. And we got Hamburg in the semi. We'd gone out there and drew 0-0. We couldn't fly because we had the ash cloud. We were stuck on the motorway in Germany for God knows how long and still managed to get a 0-0. Mm. Got back, went a goal down, and we're in the second half. And the whole stadium stands up. And do you remember the song they used to sing at the cottage, Stand Up If You Still Believe? Yeah. Which came from the relegation season. And they all started singing it. And everybody in the stadium, it was like, you know, I've seen Anfield rocking, and you know, you'll never compare, nothing compares to Anfield rocking. But for the cottage, this was a pretty big deal, let me tell you. The atmosphere was there. Anyway, we got a goal back. I think I put Digger in with a pass and he scored a brilliant goal, Simon Davis. And then we won 2-1. And it was a remarkable sense of achievement that night, because we celebrated it with our fans, that achievement.
I think Craven Cottage is a little bit of an underrated destination for football, really. It's small, but it's such a nice old ground. It's a great place to go and watch football. And you can get a good atmosphere there once they get going. I've been there a load of times and I've felt like more often than not, it's been quite decent.
It's very good. It's very good. And you normally get a good away following there, which helps. Yeah. But I loved my time playing there. I mean, we were great at home. We had a good record, which helps, because if you're getting spanked at home a lot, it doesn't feel so good, does it? But
how do you... As you say, Dan, how do you feel about Atletico Madrid dropping in from the Champions League, that team they had? I mean, it feels, looking back on it now, I've got no dog in the fight. I'm not a Fulham fan, but it feels a bit unfair, really.
Do you know what? It didn't cross my mind. I mean, they Shakhtar, Wolfsburg, Juve, all those teams, we didn't really put them on a bigger pedestal, Atletico. There was a feeling of, it's meant to be for us. Now, when you tell me now, De Gea, Aguero, Forlan, all these players they had, I'd be thinking, oh my God, little old Fulham against Sergio, come on. But at the time, they didn't have that reputation. I'd seen them play at Liverpool when they'd done Liverpool.
Would you prefer to play Liverpool?
And No.
I thought you might say that.
No. The reason being is because I knew Liverpool would take over Hamburg.
Yeah, of course.
And I knew they would dominate the stadium. And I knew that a lot of their players had played big games before. You know, Atletico were trying to win a trophy for the first time in a long time, a European one. And they had similar pressures to us. And to be honest, it wasn't a great game. We stifled them a little bit. Like we had to, because Bobby played and he wasn't fit. He had a horrendous problem and he tried to play and he shouldn't have. Andy Johnson had been injured for ages. There was our front line, really, two most attacking players. And Clint Dempsey had put his fist through the window in the semi-final and done all his tendon and had a plaster cast on his wrist when he come on, and he thought he should have been playing. So his mind wasn't really there. So we weren't a particularly good attacking threat that evening. So we had to dig in. And actually, in extra time, nothing was happening. Nothing. And I fancied us on pens because of Schwarzer.
Yeah.
You know, Mark Schwarzer was brilliant at pens. I have to say, the disappointment of... It's not even about whether you play well or not, as I told you in finals. Yeah, it's nice. It'd be great to get the winner and all that business. But the biggest disappointment was for me was... It was the only final I'd played in and lost, but it was the only final I'd played in. I was captain. And I think lifting that trophy for Fulham would have been the biggest achievement of my career.
Oh, yeah. Amazing achievement, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's still a sense of pride in what we achieved. But in complete honesty, I can say that that night was the biggest disappointment of my footballing career.
Did you look at them and think, God, they're good at the time? Or were you not really thinking about that?
Nah. I just... No one worried us then by that point. We had a little bit of a bit of confidence in terms of what we did. We'd watched a lot on Aguero and Forlan. We'd seen them destroy teams in the videos, which didn't help really. But ultimately, we weren't. They didn't have better players than Shakhtar. I mean, Shakhtar had Willian, Douglas Costa, Fernandinho, Jadson. I mean, Shakhtar was like it was like you playing FIFA football playing them.
Yeah.
You know, they were popping it about.
So you
everywhere.
Had nothing to
they
fear
better
them,
than
actually.
No. And I think it was just a game too many for us, really.
And very quickly, why did Clint put his fist through a window?
Oh, have you not heard
that
story?
I don't think you've told me. It might be well known. It might just be a gap in my knowledge. But give us a very quick rundown.
Yeah, it's a little bit. He had obviously done brilliantly in some of the previous games. And in the build-up to the... Hamburg home game in the semi-final, Clint was in the starting lineup because Bobby's injury, he'd been having a lot of injections in his Achilles, I think it was, and a lot of treatment, and he didn't think he was going to be able to play. So we set up with Clint in the team and we'd worked on everything, our tactics, what we were doing differently with Clint compared to Bobby, set plays, etc. And on the day of the game, Bobby had picked up a lot in the day and he felt whatever injection he'd had in the day, and he tried this and tried that. He came in and said, I'm all right, I can play. And put the management in a real predicament. So I'm like thinking, because I know Clint, oh dear.
A bit of a hothead.
Oh no. Well, he cares, you know what I mean? I like someone that cares. But the problem was, when the gaffer pulled him in to tell him and he come out fuming, I don't know if you've ever been in the old cottage changing rooms. There's in the corner, there's two windows, but it's toughened glass. Right. It's not normal glass. He's hit this glass. It's as good a dig as I've seen in many a year. And he's hit it that hard. It's shattered it. But his tendon and his tendon was hanging out of his finger.
God.
And all the skin had been ripped and there was blood squirting everywhere. And it was just it could have thrown a spanner in the whole evening, really, when you think back. We overcame that. Never mind the one.
As captain, though, Dan, do you have a role to play in that? Are you expected to go in there and kind of calm this down and sort of take over and do your bit?
I think there's a responsibility to try, but knowing Clint the way I did, I actually felt his pain. I actually thought he had a fair point. I don't think we should have. I mean, part of me as a player was going, is it better to have that we have Bobby in the team? Mm. Is it better that we've got Bobby, even though this is not the right way to do it? And I was thinking, actually, Clint's got a point now. You can't be told you're playing and then pulled an hour before the game say you're not playing. That doesn't wash with me. I'd be fuming, but I wouldn't have damaged myself.
No.
So I was caught between a rock and a hard place. But Clint wasn't approachable. He was he was gone. His eyes, the red mist had come in.
Yeah.
So, you know, he had to go off and calm himself. Nobody could go and speak to him.
And you're at this point, you're kind of Roy's on-field general, really, aren't you? Someone said to me at Fulham that, and you denied this at the time when I put this to you, but someone else from that squad said that you were someone who could even implement like tactical changes during the game from on the pitch, and Roy would let you do that. Are you going to deny that again?
Well, you've got to give it some context. Okay. I was allowed to do some things, but I had talked with Roy about
them.
So when I switched the wingers, or when I decided we were going to have a press, you know, with AJ, especially if AJ was playing and we had the legs behind, you know, sometimes in game I'd set the press, or I'd say to Duffers and Simon or Demps, have a switch, have a swap. Or, you know, I was allowed to do things like that. But I don't think I needed to ask Roy. I think he was fine with it anyway, to be honest. And I think there's a lot of clubs where senior players, maybe not so much now, actually. Maybe it's a dying art. Mm. Players don't want the responsibility. Mm. But I think there's a, it's even like little things. So in midfield, some manager, Martin Yol, would want you to play. If he said you're playing central midfield, he'd want you to play right central midfield or left central midfield. It wouldn't be just you two playing the middle and then you sort it out. Whereas under Roy, I would, if I was with Dixon, I'd say, look, you have 10 minutes over here now. I'm going to go and have a go on him. I don't think he can cope with this. Right. Or he's giving me a problem, Dix. You know, he keeps running in the box off me. He's too quick. And so you stick with him for 10 minutes.
Right, okay.
And we'd swap. And I'd make those little decisions myself. Whereas some managers wouldn't allow you to. I think you should let players make decisions on the pitch. You know, make some... Because otherwise, you've always got this problem where you go, you walk in the dressing room after, and don't get me wrong, you can't have every player doing what they want. But if you turn around to a manager and say, well, he's headed the ball in from the cross because you told me from the beginning of the game to play right side of midfield. I didn't know that 6'2" central midfield was going to be. I wanted to put Dixon on him, and the manager might say, why didn't you do that then?
I see what you mean.
And it's like, well, I didn't, you know. So it's kind of like I used to take some responsibility, especially as I got older at Fulham. I mean, Liverpool, we did it, actually, thinking back. Stevie was a right midfielder, a central midfielder who liked to fly, as you know. And when he flew off and made those great bursts and runs, or he got that red mist, or he wanted to go and score a goal or go and press someone, I just took in on the right and come centrally next to
Dixon. And if you were playing against Man United, they'd say, give the ball to Danny because he will score.
Well, that was another weird thing in my career that kept happening.
It's a nice thing, though, isn't it?
It was very nice. It was. It's funny, actually. I've been to some beautiful parts of the world and some remote parts. You know, talking Masai Mara, little Indian Ocean islands, and I've never been to any of them. And the Man United goals.
That's a nice thing, though. It's a nice thing to have.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing. And you don't realise when you're in it. You don't realise when you're in it how big that fixture is, you know. And I always say the same thing, and I never get tired of talking about it. Probably one of the best goals I ever scored was the Merseyside Derby. I got the winner at Goodison. And in a 2-1 game. And never, ever during my whole career or after it, when I started media, did anyone ever ask me about that goal.
It's crazy to think of, isn't it? I haven't asked you about it either, so that's, I fall into that category as well. How do you look back on your...
Nobody ever
asked. How do you look back on your career, Dan? You're obviously very proud. Like I said at the start of this, over 700 appearances, most of which came at the top level. You've achieved a hell of a lot. We've talked a little bit about the departure from Liverpool, but that aside, you must be very proud of what you've been able to achieve in the game.
Do you know what, Luke, it's a funny question because there are times and periods in my life since I finished where I think, well done you. You've done well. Yeah. Should be proud of yourself. And there's other moments and there's other times I've actually punished myself and had a go at myself and said, you could have done more.
What do you think? International football more maybe? Yeah. Or what kind of area?
It's, you know, depending on where you're at in your life and you're feeling a bit down on yourself and you think, why didn't I stay at Liverpool? Why didn't I push when I was in the England squad? Why didn't I... You know, what could I have done differently? Could I have been fitter? Could I have been more selfish? Could I have been, what could I have gone to that club instead of that club? Maybe I could have done more if I'd have only done this. You know, why didn't I do what Lampard, Gerrard and Scholes did? Why, you know, that mentality? And then the first mentality, which is the more, you know, the more clear one is actually... You know, you're a young lad from Chester, from a difficult background, who somehow found the discipline to come out of the crap Carve a career for yourself. Not only carve a career for yourself, play for the team you loved. Win trophies. Play for your country. Be remembered by many. And then go and still have a career in the game. Mm. You know, how many people would give their right arm for what I've done? You know, it's keeping it in perspective. It's difficult. I don't think it's easy to roll out the same answer to that question the whole time. It's like, oh, I'm very proud of myself. You know, I've done this and I've done this more than loads of people. But there are parts of me at times that think, you know, I could have done a bit more. Yeah. I mean, it fluctuates that.
But that feeling probably, when that comes in, that's probably a reason as to why you had such a good career, because you always felt like you could do more and you always wanted to push yourself to go better. And I think that's probably a part of it, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's very observant. I think that's definitely part of it. I don't think there's a way you get to the top and stay there without a deep hunger, desire, determination and expectancy of yourself. You know, a willingness within yourself to be the best you can be. But I also don't think it's normal to not have some self-analysis and think, could I have done more? Course.
And clearly, I mean, I know you a little bit anyway, and we talked a lot about football in the past, and you're very obviously very tactically astute and you have a good knowledge of the game. Why did you decide to go into did you decide to go into media and not coaching?
I did some badges, and I nearly got back in when Brendan changed his number 2 and 3. Gary Mack got the role that I went for. I met Brendan. It was a fascinating chat, and I was appreciative of the opportunity. And there's also a couple of opportunities that presented themselves a bit lesser down the ladder, but all presented themselves after I'd started. I mean, the Liverpool thing I would have done, of course. Yeah. You know, that's a given, but it didn't happen. The other things, I was caught between a rock and a hard place in terms of, I've got a very settled media career that I really enjoy. I've got a great life balance in terms of seeing plenty of my children, etc. Whereas the career management can be, you know, could be great, could be the door I need, could be the opening I should need to go and do a good job somewhere, then get up the ladder, then go again. And you know, you just make decisions the best way you can at the time. And I was very fortunate, really, in that I was given an opportunity to BBC very early, which I don't really know how it came about. It just did. They obviously liked something that I did. And then I've really, really benefited from doing the radio stuff. I really enjoy the radio because, as you well know, mate, it gives you a great platform to express some more in-depth views, and also let people know you've got a personality. Well, some people say, haven't they? But, you know, the personality side of it that you can bring out in radio and enjoy yourself a little bit. The TV can be a little bit serious, but I was very fortunate, and I've had lots of good opportunities through the media. I've been at some of the best tournaments. I've travelled to so many countries and stadiums and had some experiences, actually, that I've enjoyed so much more than I thought I would, and experiences I didn't think I was going to have.
And look, if you didn't do that, then we wouldn't be sat here talking. So I'm very appreciative and very grateful that you did decide to go into the media. So thank you very much for that. And thank you very much, Danny, for sharing your story with us. Really appreciate it.
No, thank you for asking me on. It's sometimes nice to reminisce and massage the ego once in a while. It's quite nice.
Well, it's been a great story. Thanks very much for sharing it, mate.
All right. Thanks, Lee. Cheers, mate.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, Listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.